And now to food delivery apps. Think Grubhub, DoorDash, Uber Eats, Eat Street, founded in Madison in over 35 states now. Should you use them? What effect do they have on the cost of doing business for your favorite local restaurant? 800-642-1234 on restaurant delivery apps. Kennedy Smith is a senior researcher for the Independent Business Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. She wrote the Institute's report called Special Delivery, about locally owned restaurant delivery businesses operating around the country. Kennedy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here today.
Good morning. These third-party online delivery apps, they seem to have exploded in the pandemic. They're still expanding. What kind of disruption have you tracked of these apps and, you know, on the restaurant industry?
Oh, gosh, the destruction has been enormous, and it kind of falls into several categories. I think the thing people think of first, of course, is the fees they charge. They charge upwards of 30% or more of what a meal costs to the restaurant. And so restaurants have, you know, typically pretty thin profit margins. They generate about, 3 to 5% profit. And if they're suddenly paying 30% out of their pocket, that's going to really, really hurt them. And, at least 100,000 restaurants we know of have closed during the pandemic. And, in part, that's one of the reasons that it's happened, because everybody suddenly was at home and had to order carry out or go out to a restaurant themselves and pick up food in order to eat instead of going to the restaurant. But there are other kinds of damage that's been caused too. Like these delivery apps kind of intercept the information that restaurants would normally be gathering about their customers, the kinds of menu items that are popular, which neighborhoods are ordering what are the demographics of people. And some of these apps are now using that information to set up their own dark kitchens and essentially compete with the restaurants who have been their clients. And then finally, there's sort of a reputational piece of this, whereas, if you're a locally owned restaurant and you deliver the food yourself, the customer knows who's responsible for the quality of the food and everything like that. If DoorDash, is delivering your food and it gets there cold or something, the customer is likely to blame the restaurant and not the delivery service. And so it's the restaurant that tends to suffer when the order is out of their hands. They've given it over to somebody who's delivering it. There isn't that level of responsibility there that there would be if it were the local restaurant itself that were making the delivery or in charge of the delivery in some way.
And so that could mean a lost customer in the future.
Absolutely.
You argue that these major food delivery apps, they offer no real economies of scale. And I'm wondering if you can pick that apart for us. Can you explain what you mean by that and what you see?
Sure. I mean, it's a very one-on-one kind of transactional business. It's not like you can ramp it up and make, X amount more money. It's a very one-to-one sort of thing. So there isn't really a benefit for a restaurant in using a delivery app like DoorDash versus one that's locally owned. There's no reason they would go with the big one because there's nothing that they're offering. And in fact, their prices are almost certainly going to be higher than a local app would be because, there's no cost savings in having a big company do it.
Let's look for a moment here at policymaking. Earlier this year, Wisconsin lawmakers had introduced a bill that would stop these third-party delivery companies from publicly offering to deliver food for restaurants without the restaurant's permission. Have you seen this approach to regulation in other areas, other places?
Oh, yeah, sure. There are close to 100 cities and several states that have passed regulations of various sorts that sort of manage how these apps can work during the pandemic. Some of them put a cap on the fees that can be charged, capping them at 10% or 15% and not letting them get away with those 30 or 40% charges. But many of them also deal with that information sort of capture that I was talking about, making sure that restaurants aren't listed without their explicit permission, because there's all kinds of stuff that can go wrong there. One of the things that some of the big apps have done, for example, is to create sort of parallel web pages. So for example, there's one in my neighborhood in Arlington, Virginia. It's an Indian restaurant called Aroma, and their website is called Aroma Restaurant. Well, somebody set up a website that's called Aroma Indian Restaurant, and it redirects calls directly to a second phone number that belongs to a delivery app. So the restaurant isn't even getting that information. They don't even know they're listed there. and the order is being intercepted. A delivery person goes to the restaurant, pays with a credit card. The restaurant doesn't have a clue that that's not an individual who's just ordering the food for himself or herself. And off it goes. And then they're charging the fee onto the customer there. So, you know, lots of stuff like that has happened. And that has, like I said, had both a financial and a reputational impact on restaurants. And so for that reason, many of these communities and states have taken action to prohibit that from happening and saying you have to have a contract with a restaurant before you can list them on your website without their permission. There's also a trademark component of that, you know, of using their logo and their menu without their permission.
Wow, I would imagine. And, you know, California has this Fair Food Delivery Act, as you mentioned, you know, requiring these apps to have a partnership agreement with each restaurant they list. Have you found what impact has that had?
Well, a really good one, because it means that restaurants aren't being duped or being sidelined in this process. There are all kinds of horror stories too out there about. There was a restaurant that I read about in Missouri, for example, where they had they found that one of the big apps had listed them without their permission. They protested, and it took them some doing, but they were able to persuade the app to take them off of their platform. And then they found that they were actually still listed on the platform, but when someone clicked on them, clicked on their restaurant, not knowing this whole story, they were getting a pop-up message saying that restaurant was no longer offering delivery. There was another restaurant, this one was in California, where a similar thing happened. And what would happen is if somebody clicked on them and put in an address to say, I want my order delivered to, you know, 123 Main Street, they would get a pop-up saying that it was outside the delivery range. The restaurant owner thought that was weird. And so she placed an order herself, putting in the address right next door to her restaurant, and got that pop-up message saying that it was outside the delivery range. So the app was just being vindictive and was trying to punish her for canceling her contract.
Wow. Kennedy Smith with a senior researcher at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. This is a nonprofit research and advocacy group looking to protect communities against concentrated economic power. She wrote the Institute's report on local food delivery businesses. Join in on food delivery apps, these economies of scale, what app you use and why, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Kennedy Smith here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about food delivery apps and locally based businesses now that have popped up in that space. According to the Wall Street Journal earlier this year, food delivery companies saw continued growth in 2021. DoorDash, the largest food delivery company by market share, reported revenue at roughly $5 billion last year, up 69%. From 2020. Join in on delivery apps, how you see their role in your community. Maybe you're a driver. Join in 800-642-1234. Kennedy Smith of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance studies this sector and is with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Kennedy, bring us to 2017. Grubhub buys a delivery service company in Iowa City and doubled the commission on food orders to 30%. How did the local restaurants respond there in Iowa?
Yeah, they were not happy about that, as you can imagine. And so what they did was they formed their own co-op owned by the restaurant owners. A collection of restaurants got together. They hired their own driver. And, you know, it only cost them 15% to make that all work financially. And it works really well. And that co-op model, in fact, is now sort of being franchised around the country. Communities like Las Vegas and some places in northern Colorado have adopted it, and more are looking at doing the same thing.
What about these co-ops in terms of the safety and working conditions of delivery drivers? What do you see there?
Well, you know, one of the great things about these locally based platforms, ordering platforms, is that they really do care about their drivers. And they, you know, some of them, there are lots of different models out there. Every community kind of adapts this to its own particular needs. But there are some, like there's a delivery co-op in Lexington, Kentucky, which is called Delivery Co-op. And the drivers themselves can become owners of the co-op after working for the company for a certain period of time, for, I think, 3 months. So they have profit sharing, you know, they have health insurance. It's just a much better deal for the drivers.
is that sustainable? Will that model work in the long run?
Yeah, it will. You know, when you begin to sort of peel apart the different layers of what's involved in food delivery, there are, you know, certain sort of, you know, tangible fees, like what does it cost to process a credit card? What does it cost to maintain the platform, to have the website where people can order and, you know, manage the data and things like that? And then what do you pay the drivers? But that's pretty, you know, you can look at those different components and charge them to different entities. So the restaurant might absorb the credit card processing fee, for example, but it might be the customer who pays for the driver, because it's basically a service that they're buying. It's not the food, they're buying the service of having the food delivered to them. And so each of these local models that we've been following have sort of, you know, balanced that in a different way. So this one in Lexington, Kentucky that I just mentioned, which is called Delivery Co-op, it's a co-op, but it's also membership based for its customers. So customers pay a flat $25 a month, and for that they get unlimited deliveries from the participating restaurants. And then the restaurants themselves pay $300 a month as a membership fee. And with that, then it's perfectly sustainable. I think they had to hit something like 120 or 130 monthly subscriber customers in order to make it work. And now it's growing.
What has happened to the big players in those markets? What happens to the Grubhub and the DoorDash when communities band together like that?
Well, you know, one of the really interesting things is that when one of these local delivery services has popped up, it's like everyone in the community suddenly gets the issue and realizes, oh, wait a minute. You know, by ordering from DoorDash or Grubhub or Uber Eats, I thought that I was supporting local restaurants, but now I realize that I'm not, because simply the fact that this one is here and is promoting the fact that it's charging restaurants less, I get it. So their business is definitely dropping off.
Kennedy Smith with us, studies independent business development, senior researcher for the Nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance, wrote a report on food delivery service alternatives. You can join in 800-642-1234. Jack is joining us from Madison. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. What would you like to bring up?
Hey, I just wanted to comment. I used to live in China. I just moved back to the U.S. A few months ago, and the food delivery business in China is huge. I would order food all the time in China, and it was so cheap. I think the delivery service only charged maybe 2 or 3% to deliver food. And upon coming back to the United States, I got DoorDash. And I ordered one time. I just couldn't believe how expensive it was, how much they charge to deliver your food. So after that, I've never used them again. I've been trying to stick to just ordering, or to just going to the grocery store, buying my groceries, or just physically going to the restaurant. Even if I can't go in, I'll order pickup directly through the restaurant. I just think they charge so much money to deliver. So, yeah, I just wanted to comment on the differences between countries, I guess. So,
Jack, thank you for that comparison. Kennedy, you know, Jack bringing up lots of good points here. What do you make of comparisons of the U.S. and other countries in how these apps operate?
Well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, for a long, long time in the U.S., who delivered food, what restaurants? It was typically pizza, mm-hmm. and it was Chinese food. That's mm-hmm. what you usually, you know, before the 2010s, that's kind of what we had. And I think that China is a good example, because it points out the fact that if the magnitude of the ordering population is big enough, you really can drive down the cost significantly. And 2 or 3% is, you know, what, if everybody were sort of on board with this, it would probably cost. I think that Jack's point also underscores one of the real benefits of these locally based ordering platforms, is that they keep the money in the community. They're building local wealth. Instead of basically just sending that 30% of a meal cost off to, you know, corporation and its shareholders and investors. Instead, it's keeping it local, and that has a multiplier effect on the community in terms of, you know, the drivers who drive there and pay their own rent there and buy their own groceries there, and everyone else, the restaurant owners. It's really building the local economy and not undercutting it.
Jack made some changes, as we heard, using the grocery store, going to directly to the restaurant to do that takeout. How should people think about their local economy when using these types of apps? Do you have any tips for us?
Well, I mean, the important thing is to really think through, where is this money going? You know, if I'm ordering from this restaurant, but I'm being charged 30% for delivery, you know, who is that really benefiting? Where's the benefit going? And there are ways that communities can, you know, develop their own platforms, their own delivery services, even piggybacking on existing services that are already there. I've seen several communities that have just tapped into existing, you know, bicycle courier networks and are having those bicycles, you know, now be their delivery service, or using existing taxi services. There are all kinds of ways to make it work that don't involve, you know, having to have a fancy platform and having to use some big corporation to make it happen. So I think just thinking through what infrastructure do we already have in place that we can mobilize is a good place to start.
You mentioned earlier some of these really exploitative tactics that these companies are doing. What about litigation here? Are restaurants pushing back?
Restaurants are pushing back, and so are customers. There are a couple of lawsuits that have popped up in New York State, for example, some by restaurant owners themselves, and then others just by groups of customers who are saying, you know, we're being exploited, you know, at the consumer end of this. So the courts are definitely taking a look at it. Congress has taken a look at it. The Federal Trade Commission has taken a look at it. And I think it's an evolving legal landscape at this point. But I think we're going to see a lot more action coming up in the next year or so.
Is that what you have your eye on here as this type of market industry continues to evolve and seems like it's gaining momentum?
Yeah, I mean, we're obviously tracking it pretty carefully. At the same time, wanting to put out some practical tools like this publication that you mentioned, which is really, you know, sort of a policy guide, but also a how-to guide on how a community can take this into their own hands and develop a platform and a system that really works for them. One of the great things about the local platforms that I've explored and the owners that I've spoken with are that they really adapt them in very innovative and novel ways to each community's particular needs and its personalities. Mm-hmm. And it's really wonderful to see that come through in these, you know, dozens of examples across the country.
Kennedy, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Kennedy Smith is senior researcher for the Nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance. We have a link to the report at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, the number of adults with ADHD more than doubled between 2007 and 2016. A psychiatrist joins us to explain why it's challenging to diagnose and treat adult ADHD and a new medication on the horizon. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.